Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM, Seattle. The best in true crime, conspiracy, and history with Al Warren and Kev Thompson.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren and...
I'm Kev Thompson.
Okay. So I have to bring this up again. Heather Locklear, I'm over it. Three times the charm. She got arrested again, you know, for assault and kicking. And let's give her a felony. Let's put her away. I'm done.
Well, generally it is a felony. You know, your third time around is a charm.
No, they just, you know, come on. Same as her DUI. They give her informal probation.
Home arrest.
That's what
I wish I could get home arrest.
Yeah, that's what I could do. You know,
just hang out at the house in my underwear and eat Cheetos and do jail time.
That sounds like your life now. Oh, okay. Now, so what else is? Oh, this is what day are we in the on the crazy train? 5:21 on the crazy train. Call it. Oh boy, nothing but fun. And thank God we're taking care of those Canadians. Mean old things.
We'll show you.
Shoes. Yeah, steal our shoes. Finally got someone to take care of them. God. Okay. Now, and of course, we had Roger Stone, and that was an interesting conversation. That's too bad he doesn't like Max Holland. And he calls him a liar. I can't believe it.
Boy,
I mean, that he attacked him on air. I can't believe it because Max Holland was good. I mean, he seems to be legitimate and a real research. I didn't get any vibes, did you?
Wow, Roger just came out swinging.
Yeah, because, you know, really, he's got the LBJ tapes. They are what they are. It's not really... It's not fake news. He's got the tapes.
It's there.
I don't know what the problem is. But we all love Roger. He dresses well. If he knew that you weren't in slacks, he'd be mad at you.
Oh. Well, it's Friday. It's Dress Down Friday.
Yeah, wife beater day. And now, speaking of wife beating, we've got an author on today with in just true crime. And actually we had demand for this author, and this is great. I mean, it's the Cougar group of New Orleans came after us and said we had to get him on. So we did. And he's got a great name, Alan Gautreau. Thank you for being on the show.
Okay. Yeah. Gautreau. Yeah.
Go
okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm okay. You Yankees are so funny. Yes.
Okay. Go throw. Okay.
Yeah.
I sure. Got it. Okay. I'm sorry. Okay. Now, now you're a history teacher. So you're one of those guys teaching our kids history.
Yes. Well, actually, I teach at a community college.
Oh.
So they're a little bit older. And sometimes you have to change what they think. No, I'm just kidding. We are. I use a crystal ball and, you know, breathing techniques. No, yeah. I teach world history and American history to basically college sophomores. who are trying to get to go on for a 4-year degree. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do for a living. So
I don't write
for a living.
No. Have you been doing that for a long time?
I've been teaching for 18 years. I started at the middle school level, which we used to call, state penitentiary junior high. And before that, I was a paralegal. Before that, I was a police officer. And I served my country in the United States Army before I became a police officer. So it's a lot of fun. You know, when it stops being fun, you stop doing it. And at this level, it's a lot of fun. When it stops being fun, you stop doing it.
Time to move on. But I was going to say, have you noticed a difference in the generations now when you're teaching history as opposed to 10 years ago even?
I find that, it also depends on the age of the student, too, Al. I mean, I've got students now that range from anywhere from 17 years old all the way up to 60. When you're in middle school, they're there because they have to be. In community college, some of them are there because they have to be, but I try to make it as a pleasant as experience as possible for them. And the difference in the students is, basically, they're more aware to their surroundings, both cultural and political. And it's easy to teach. You know, some people, Al, when you get them in a class, they're just not going to get it. All right. Yeah. The light bulb just never goes on. And a lot of times you have to deal with that. Now, I not only teach at a community college, I also teach at a 4-year college that has a program that I'm in that if you don't make a certain grade on the ACT or SAT, they put you in this program so that you can connect to the 4-year colleges. And a lot of them haven't matured enough. They still think it's high school, and you struggle with that as a teacher sometimes. And other times you just say, you know, if you don't get it, you don't get it. I know this already. You have to know this. So have I seen a difference? I forgot what the original question was.
Well,
okay.
What I was getting at was I was just wondering if let's say your students today, like this, right now, as compared to let's say 10 years ago, do they have the same interest in history, and do they have the same passion for it, or is it different?
Oh, it's more. It's not really passionate. It's more of they want to learn about it. And I tell a lot of people, you know, you're not going to know where you're going unless you know where you've been. And, you know, history teaches us these lessons, and it tends to repeat itself occasionally. And they wouldn't understand it 10 years ago, but today they do, because they see a lot of things that are happening that in little ways, Al, not the big stuff, in little ways, they see how history tends to repeat itself. So as far as, you know, that's concerned, it's not a passion for history, but they feel like, you know, I should have paid attention 10 years ago when I was in high school or whatever. Because I'm learning more now. And I think it's because of the presentation of the material. I use a little levity, you know, and a little humor to do that, because history can be a boring subject to a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd imagine. Especially at the college age, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They're looking for the bars.
Now,
so how does a teacher and... ex-cop military get into writing books like you've done? You've done some history, and of course we're going to talk about true crime, but what led you into actually writing books?
Okay, that sounded real intelligent. What led me into writing books was about 28 years ago, I had written an article for a crime magazine. And the crime magazine, I don't even think it exists today. It was True Detective. I don't even know if it's still published.
Oh, wow. I wrote
a story called, it was about the Axeman of New Orleans, a serial killer that was never caught in 1918-1919. And then I wrote another article. I got $275 for this article. You know, 1990, that's a lot of money. It's a lot of money today for teachers.
Yeah.
And then I wrote another article on a crime that took place here in Louisiana. It was called the Baseball Bat Murders. And these two guys claimed that they were fighting for over 10 hours and did not see one of the guy's wives 15 feet away, who had been just brutalized, and got that published. And I didn't publish anything for, about 10 years. And then when I got into graduate school, I wrote a paper on, there was a lynching down here in 1891. There was about 11 Italians that were killed down here. And I turned it into my master's thesis. And then without my permission, one of my professors sent the thesis away, and it was published in not only in a journal, but a publishing company picked it up a year later and published it in a book. And I decided to take the book and expand it, because a lot of people, you know, there's two types of people in this world, Al.
Yeah.
those who are Italian and those that want to be Italian, especially down here. And so a lot of people enjoyed the book. And so I was working at a small community college in New Orleans proper, and my office mate taught criminal justice. And he said, hey, we ought to write a book together. Well, I had experience with the true crime articles, and I said, okay. So I started putting stories together and came up with Dark Bayou. And I sent it to one publisher, and 2 days later, we had a contract with the publisher because they liked the material. This genre is very popular. It's always been very popular. And then I wrote Bloodstained Louisiana, in fact, in about 7 months. And the publisher keeps asking me, you know, it's getting to the point with this publisher that if I write a grocery list, they want to publish it. And I went back, you know, I can't believe. So they're waiting for another book. I'm doing another true crime, but I really like to get back to my roots eventually.
Yeah.
You know, so I get a lot of exposure on your show. Of course, I like to expose myself. So,
perfect. That's what we do.
Anyway, fit right in.
So, but you know, hopefully, you know, it takes audience. You got to build an audience, Alan Kev. You got to build an audience, and you know, Dark Bayou came out 3 years ago, and Bloodstained came out in November of 2017. They're doing okay. I mean, how do you do that? How do you gauge how a book is doing? I mean, is it because of the royalty checks, or is it because of, you know, how many speaking engagements you do? Like I said, this is like only the third radio interview I've had in 7 years. You know, everybody goes, oh, you're famous, you're successful. You know, how do you judge success in the publishing business?
Yeah. No, it's a tough one, because I go through the same thing. You don't know, but then sometimes you do well and sometimes you don't. I think the main thing is that people are reacting to it, whether it's five people this month and then 100 next month or whatever it is, but people are still doing it. And I ask the publisher all the time, mine, you know, is that good or bad, or is that okay? And he always answers, I have people that can't sell any. So you're doing good.
Okay.
So
yeah. Well, it's kind of like when you're looking at, you know, you feel sick. You may have the flu.
Yeah.
You know, or a lot of people think they have a monopoly on problems, and then you see somebody else that's doing worse. Well, right. You know, that makes you feel better at that time, but in the publishing business, well, he's not selling any, but how many am I selling?
Yeah.
You see? How is that doing?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. So. No, it's been doing okay. You know, I used to really be hard on it and be looking at the charts all the time. And I'm not so much now, because, you know, you get people. The reviews, I don't take reviews well. I don't know about you, but you'll get.
Well, I look at it this way. I look at it this way, Al. Libraries are named after authors. I don't know any libraries that are named after reviewers.
Hey, touche.
Okay, that's how I had one bad interview where this guy said my book was nothing but yellow journalism. And the thing is that, you know, and it's only one bad review. Everybody says, well, one bad review, it's, you know, that's a, well, you know, it's a review. It, you know, eventually, you know, I mean, you get angry.
Yeah.
Okay, Adam, sometimes. But you got to remember, these people, like, you know, Kev, you said Kev's sitting in his basement in his underwear eating chiwis.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to realize a lot of these people are doing the same thing.
So, and I review books.
Oh, well, I have a few books too, you know, but I don't do it with any type of animus involved. I look at it from an objective point of view as an historian who's been studying history since I was 8, all right, and now I'm 54 years old. There's very little that gets past me. I mean, I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination. But sometimes you read books with dates that are wrong, that names are spelled differently. And that's the nitpicky stuff.
Right.
When you're doing a history book, did the author convey the event? All right. Is did they use, you know, clear enough language to convey the event? If they didn't, I mean, I've never really trashed a book per se, but the guy that gave me the wrong interview, I mean, the bad review, he is a self-proclaimed best-selling author.
Wow.
And I've asked some of my friends, have you heard of this guy? Never heard of him. Well, he's a leadership person. Well, that doesn't say much about his leadership. If he's going to take a book, I mean, you got to find good things with the book as well as not so good things out. Mm-hmm. You can't just, you know, trash somebody because they can do it to you. They can really do it to you. So yeah, that's how I look at bad reviews. Now, the other thing you can do is just, you know, slam down some German beer and, you know, smoke a cigar and just, you know, use explicatives, you know, and get even. But the thing is, you got to let bad reviewers know it didn't get to you.
Yeah, that's no, I don't do any responding anymore. I don't bother.
Mm-hmm.
It's not worth it.
Wait a minute. You used to?
At the very beginning.
You used to?
Well, you know what I would do, actually? I would get someone that would write something really nasty. And then so then I would mm-hmm. write back, and then I would erase it, or I wouldn't send it, so... Not really, but now I don't even tangle that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not worth it.
No,
because you know, in the beginning, I feel it would hurt your feelings in the beginning because you feel like you've mm-hmm. put yourself on those pages. You know, you've
always
exposed a part of yourself, and now you're feeling rejected.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just gaining the confidence in your writing as well. I think, which takes time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like us with the radio stuff now, and you know, it's kind of funny now when people say things. Call me horror.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Well, how many cougar votes do they get?
Well, I tell you what, Al. What you ought to do is put that on your business card.
Yeah.
Al Horror Warren.
That's right.
So there's no doubt. There's no doubt.
Yeah.
But yeah, the bad reviews and Kev's right. You know, Kev, you don't talk much, do you?
No, I'm just letting you, Arthas, go at it here.
Okay. Well, I'm just a person. I have feelings. Okay. All right. But no, the bad reviews are, you know, you've got to ignore them because there are people out there that do love it, that do like, you know, your writing. And yeah. So I don't know anybody personally, Al, but, you know, I'm sure I'll find someone.
I don't either.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Yeah.
No, so, they do fine.
Anyway. Mm-hmm.
Do fine.
But I haven't had any reviews for Bloodstained yet. You know, you run into a lot of people. And I'll give you an example, and then we can go on with the show instead of bullwhacking. But the Italian book, whenever I do, it's called Italian Louisiana, History, Heritage, and Tradition. And there are certain crimes. There are crimes in there because the Italian people actually did, which I'm going to get to when we talk about the Walter Lamanna case. They did feel as though they were not going to be able to assimilate. So what happens is when I go to these book signings, before I even speak, people will walk up to the Italian book and look in the index. Do you know what they're looking for? Their last name.
Oh.
They're looking for their last name. And some people get offended. And I said, look, you've got to understand, this is about the Italian people as a whole. It doesn't have to deal with just one particular family. Because if I wrote about all the particular families, the Italian Louisiana would be about 140 volumes long. You know, so this was just taking it and putting it and encapsulating. People need to feel like they have a part in the writing. You might say that's kind of far out. I gave up smoking weed a long time ago. So the one thing
just
that
in time when it's legal,
they have to remember.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I can't wait to not down here yet.
Then he's gonna start getting paranoid. Anyway, so the one thing that you have to remember is that people feel a part of the writing. And when they see, and I'm not trying to get, you know, ephemeral on you, you know, like, oh, we all have to just, you know, we have to meditate and stuff before we read books. No, it's they feel a part of the writing. They feel a part of it. And the people that don't are the ones that write the bad reviews. That's what I was trying to tell you. If they don't feel the writing. So anyway.
Totally. Now these murders, how did you select them for the book in Bloodstained, Louisiana?
What I do generally, and I'm speaking to both Al and Kev, wake up. And so what I do is I look, I don't use Wikipedia a lot because I know it's kind of it's kind of biased because you can edit those articles.
Yeah. Right?
Well, it's not when dependable. I look for things, it's not
yeah.
dependable.
The public dependable. Contributes no. to it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's not academically sound.
Right, exactly. And so what I did was I looked for things that were obscure. And this takes a little time because you actually now I have access to newspapers from my home, so I don't have to go look at microfilm anymore, which, as you know, takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
So if you plug in search terms and you look for them, these things come up. Now, a lot of people who don't live in Louisiana may not have heard of the stories. I kind of write it for like a regional audience more than a national audience, you might say. But my books are more popular history than they are academic. And I don't mean to offend any academics, but a lot of times academic writing is very boring. Yeah. And it's just it's written for other academics, you see? So even though I do have, you know, a master's degree or whatever, I try to stay away from that. But picking the stories is very easy because Louisiana is full of them. We are full of all these stories. Yeah. But we're full of all these stories, and they're not hard to find down here. And so, and a lot of people want to read about these things. In fact, the first story we're going to talk about is called The Business of the Black Hand. It took place in 1907. It has to do with the murder of a little boy. And when I tried to interview family members, they didn't want to talk about it. And that's 107 years later. They just do not want to talk about it. Well, actually, 110 years later. It's still painful for the family to talk about it. And it's very difficult to find people that will talk about these things.
Right.
But that's how I choose them. That's how I choose them. If they're obscure, yeah. I mean, for instance, The Axeman of New Orleans was my first article. There was a book that came out last year by an academic. And how is it that, you know, I often get that question. How do you decide what you're going to write about?
Really, and that's a fascinating story.
The answer for true crime, or I do historical crime, okay? That's what I call it, because there's a lot of research involved in it. When you do research for that, a lot of times in true crime, it's always the goriest, most macabre, most bizarre stories you can find. In Louisiana, the truth is stranger than fiction a lot of the times. Now, there have been really odd murder cases, you know. We look at, for instance, if you look at Villisca, Iowa, the axe murders that took place in Villisca in 1912, did you know that there were four other murders before that one took place in the Midwest that had the exact same signature as Villisca? So a lot of people, wow, I didn't know that. So it's basically, you know, they enjoy it. Sometimes it's just the treatment, though, Al, the treatment of the story. You know, it could be done hundreds of times, but it's just the treatment of the story. Okay, let me know when I'm boring you.
It's good.
Just the treatment of the story. So.
Well, yeah.
That's how I take them.
Yeah, no, and I think that makes the difference because that's when people relate to you and how you present the story, it's just what the connection is, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you choose as an author? How do you choose the stories that you do?
Well, they fall into me usually, so it's not like, well, I mean, the one that's coming out next was a man that was put away for murdering a little girl in 57 that didn't do it and got out 2 years ago
oh.
and lives in the Seattle area. And they we fell into each other a couple of years ago, and so that sort of, so it kind of comes across, it just it comes across me, and then it just happens. So
okay, you know, and
that would seemed really interesting to me.
So
that's really, I also look for some sort of benefit out of it. You know, so I wanted to tell the story for him and not, not so much about the killing.
Right. And a lot of times people concentrate on the crime and the murders.
Right.
A lot, I kind of try to put focus onto the victims and the victims' families, because one of the books that I wrote was dedicated to the victims so they wouldn't be forgotten. And thank God we did, because one of the stories that we did in Dark Bayou, this baseball bat murder, one of the guys got out of prison in December of 2016, and he should have stayed there. I mean, but all because, you know, he was a writer. They had a magazine at the prison, and he was the editor and all that, and he won awards. That does not bring the woman back to life.
Right.
And I was a little miffed about it, but, you know, case of Asura, there's nothing really much you can do about it unless there's any new evidence that could put him back. But, and, you know, like you said, sometimes they fall into you. Sometimes you run into them. That's how I do these things. I'm fascinated with crime techniques and how police actually went about discovering who the murderers are at that point in history. And in Bloodstained, Louisiana, in fact, I cover six women who murdered their paramours because they were jilted, or they felt that they were jilted, or that they got into an affair with a married man and he wouldn't leave his wife to go with them. There was an unwritten law in the United States that basically stated that if a woman felt that she was jilted, she had justification to murder her lover.
Oh, and wow.
So there's six stories in Bloodstained, Louisiana, where sometimes they get off and sometimes they don't, but they use it was called exactly the unwritten law. And a lot of people at that time says, well, if it applies to females, why doesn't it apply to males as well? Bloodstained, Louisiana covers a lot of things that are social issues, too. And I didn't realize that until after I had written the book. So that's how I pick my stories. If they're macabre and they're strange and people find them fascinating, then I go ahead and write about them.
Yeah. Well, there also has to be enough information for you to compile the story. When you run into family members that aren't willing to talk, where do you go to give the information, or do you just move on to another story?
Well, if you go into some of these stories and you can't get primaries, there's still other primaries out there. Down here, we have a very big collection of court records, and you can glean a lot from court records. You know, if there's in fact, one of the stories I might talk about today, I read the whole file. There was a confession in this thing, and there was very little primary source. There's other ways to find it, and there's other ways that you can take the information and you can apply it toward the story. So you don't necessarily need to interview people per se. And I'll give you an example, Kevin. There's a story that I'm working on for the new book that involves a murder and a disappearance. Well, I interviewed the daughter of the woman who disappeared, and we have gotten such a professional relationship going that I'm starting to, she can say something, or she doesn't have to say anything, and I could basically tell you what she's going to say, because this was her mother. The woman disappeared when she was 9 years old, and her paramour, her lover, was killed brutally, and they haven't found anybody to charge with the crime. But one of the main suspects of the case, the daughter interviewed him for 6 hours. Just interviewed him, just went inside and said, I want to talk about this. And she's getting ready to send me the tapes so that I could digitalize them and do that. So that's one instance when I talk to a family member. But you don't really need that type of closeness. And what it does, Kevin, if you do get that close, you lose your objectivity. So I try not to get that close. Everything's viewed from above. It's omnipotent, and you do the best you can. The newspapers, a lot of times people rely on them for primary source. Sometimes you got to read between the lines, and then your writing will reflect that. I hope I answered his question. Is he still awake?
Yes, I'm here.
okay. All right.
The cohort. Okay. He's always there.
Okay.
Now you were starting to talk about the murder of Walter LaManna. LaManna?
Yes.
What was the story there? Like, what? How did that connect with you?
Well, Walter LaManna, when I was doing research for the Italian book, and I ran across the story, and I put a summarized version of it in the Italian Louisiana book. I always had an interest in the Italians in Louisiana, the Italians in the nation in general, immigration in the diaspora and all of that. The one thing I learned is that there's more to Italians than the mafia. All right, there's more to them than that. And every time I interviewed somebody about it, whenever I'd say, talk about the mafia and how they worked in New Orleans, they go, "Pooh, they don't want to talk about the mafia." So I kept the mafia out of that book. But I found one, I found a crime that they have, if you ever heard of the Mano Nero, which is the Black Hand. There's been all kinds of organizations throughout history named the Black Hand, but these guys were especially brutal. The Black Hand was an extortion, kind of like a subset of the mafia, and they would extort people for money. And I found out there was one crime in Louisiana that they were involved in heavily, and that was the LaManna kidnapping. Now, Walter LaManna was the son of Peter LaManna, who was an undertaker in the French Quarter of New Orleans. Back around that time, the French Quarter was considered a slum and a home for the Italians that were coming to the United States, specifically Louisiana. Now you can't get a piece of property under $10 million in the French Quarter in New Orleans. If you've ever been there, you know. But the kidnapping of Walter LaManna had a lot of aspects to it that I was very interested in. And one of them was that it was the extortion aspect, and then it was how the communities reacted to Walter LaManna being kidnapped. On June 8th of 1907, his mother called all the kids to dinner, and an hour later, Walter hadn't shown up, so they started to worry. And Peter LaManna was very well off because he did a lot of funerals for the well-to-do Italians in the area. The one thing I have to tell people when I talk about this is Italians in Louisiana held the same status as freed blacks after the Civil War. And the reason for that being is that the Italians had suffered prejudice in their home country, but they didn't exhibit it. You understand what I'm saying? They when they got to the New World, when they got to the United States, they didn't have any prejudices. In Louisiana, Italians and Sicilians were invited to come here, and by the white population, who felt that they could supplement their own population and kind of put the blacks on notice. Hey, we got more whites now. But that's not what happened. When the Italians came over here, they didn't exhibit any prejudice. So what they did was they intermingled with blacks in Louisiana. And so that's how they drew the ire of whites. The white establishment here in Louisiana, and Italians were treated very badly. So in 1891, like I said before, there was a lynching in New Orleans of 11 Italians who allegedly murdered a police chief. The Italians were gaining ground in assimilation, and the Walter LaManna case was the case that told the Italians, hey, we finally made it, because when this little boy disappeared, it wasn't just the Italians looking for him, it was the whites too. So eventually what happens is Peter LaManna receives a ransom note for $6,000. You know, your son is eating well. If you know, $6,000 in 1907 is a lot of money.
Yeah.
In fact, that was probably a year's salary for Peter LaManna, even though he was considered well-to-do. The police get involved. Now, this is before Miranda. This is back where we used to call the rubber hose age. So when you brought in a suspect, he didn't really have any rights. And they would extract confessions. Well, a lot of these people that were arrested, they arrested over 9 people for the kidnapping and murder. What they did was they found Walter LeMahieu's body in the place where I currently live, which is Kenner, Louisiana, which was a big Italian enclave out here. And they found his body. He didn't have a head, and he didn't have arms and legs.
Oh, no.
And it was a little boy. They identified him through one of the killers, told him who it was. But they eventually found the head. And 7 people were put on trial. 5 of them received life sentences, and 2 of them received the death sentence for it. The problem being is that when you condemn somebody to death back then, if they were Italian, it was just like whites were getting their revenge. But with this case, it was different. The Italian people wanted these 2 executed because they felt that, you know, when you're doing true crime, you said that you wrote a book about this guy who allegedly killed a young girl.
Right.
Okay. I don't know if you go through this, but I go through periods of very short depression when I'm doing research when it has to do with a child. And that's what drew me to this story, was because it brought the Italians and the whites together, and the people that deserved what they did, killing this young boy. I mean, I can't give you a lot of the particulars because the chapter is almost 30 pages long, but Peter LeMahieu never recovered. His wife never recovered. And Walter had a twin. Her name was Octavia. And she would later have problems with alcoholism and things of that nature. So it was more or less of this story had a cause and effect for me. I don't like seeing when defenseless children are brutalized like this child was. And now, after I did that, after I wrote the story, I started to understand why the family couldn't talk about it any longer.
Yeah.
Because it still affected them 107 years later. But what happens is the Italian people come together, and with the whites, and the city starts to hire more Italian detectives after this case. And Walter LeMahieu is buried in one of the most famous cemeteries in the city. That's Metairie Cemetery. They have a Louisiana Heritage Trail that you go on, and he's buried in there. And so it was kind of like that final step that the Italians had to take to be assimilated into Louisiana culture. Not necessarily United States culture, but Louisiana culture, because everybody talked about poor little Walter LeMahieu. So that's what drew me to the story. And the research was phenomenal. It was a good story. And a lot of people didn't remember it, but they remember LeMahieu Panofalo Funeral Homes that was very popular down here. And everybody goes, oh, I recognize that name. Yes, that's the son of the man who founded the funeral home. So that's what drew me to the story. And I think, did Kevin ask me something about Italians? I think he said something.
No.
What drew me to the Italians? Let me tell you something. I was very objective when I started writing about the Italians. And then 50 pounds later, because they don't let you leave the house without feeding you.
Right.
I managed to get an understanding of Italian culture. In fact, I was going to change my name for a while. I thought I couldn't find anything that went with Gotro other than Eni. So I was going to be Gotro Eni, and people wouldn't understand that. But that's what drew me to this story. And people find it very fascinating because, we deal with, and there was some talk about lynching the people that were guilty. So, when you deal with that Louisiana history, that's a blemish on Louisiana history. One of many. So, I hope I answered your question. I keep forgetting what you asked me half the time.
Who is this?
Who is this?
Who is this again?
Mom?
Yeah.
That's, Mom?
Yeah. Go ahead, Kev.
No, one thing that I'm missing in the story, though, is did he pay the ransom and they killed the child anyways?
No, the child was already dead before the ransom note was sent. The child had been dead about 4 days because what happened was they brought him to a little cabin out in where Kenner, where I live, and he wouldn't shut up. He wouldn't be quiet. and he's crying for his mom and all this stuff. And one of the guys, one of the men who was executed, was only one, really, because there was a woman. The gentleman's name was Leonardo Gabia. And he actually strangled Walter to death. And then they dismembered the body. And then by that time, Leonard Gabia was kind of like the henchman that panicked. And when the boss came in, a guy by the name of Ignacio Campisano, and saw what he had done, he said, okay, now what are we going to do with the body? Well, they had already sent the ransom note. They actually sent two of them, but only one of them had demanded money. But they had already killed the boy. The Black Hand was very ruthless. What they used to do is if they kidnapped somebody before, and in a lot of cases, they used to take a finger or an ear, and they'd send it back to the person they were asking money from because they wanted to prove that that was that person. In fact, right. There was a gentleman in Sicily who was his last name was Rose. They sent back both his ears to his wife. In England, he went from he was in England. He went to Sicily to do some visiting. He was a tourist, but no, Peter LaManna didn't pay the money. You know, back then we didn't have the Federal Bureau of Investigation to monitor phones and whatever traffic there was. So it was Peter LaManna said that he was going to find his son, and when he found out he was murdered, this was really grotesque. Al and Kevin, they you know, back then, they didn't have plastic bags to put evidence in. And when Peter LaManna was on the stand at the trial of Leonard Gabia, the clothing was still bloody, sitting on the table with a tag on it. Now, for a parent to see that is very traumatic. And so he said that he wanted to kill them. He was going to take out a vendetta against them to kill them, but they were too well protected. And when the mother got on the stand, Miss Marie LaManna, she couldn't testify because she couldn't talk. She was just so choked up. And the newspapers made a comment about it that it was really kind of over the top that the prosecutor would do that, put the bloody clothing on to the prosecution table. But it had the desired effect on the jury. Right. And that's what
the shock factor.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So... but after that, you know, Italians were not, you know, they had the nicknames for them, you know, I'm sure, and I'm not going to say them on the air, but there was a lot of nicknames for them. But they got along, whites got along better with the Italians after this case. So it did have a very productive effect on Louisiana culture and society.
Right, right. Something good came out of the evil in it.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Now, what can you tell us about the another case what was I thinking of? I was thinking of the butterfly.
The butterfly man?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the butterfly man. This took place during the Great Depression in Louisiana. And as we all know, you don't have to be a history graduate to understand the impact that the Great Depression had on families. And it was a time of unprecedented economic suffering. But for Louisiana, it was economically devastating because Louisiana was mostly a rural state back then. And there was a lot of great poverty down here. And the butterfly man's an interesting case, and I'll tell you why a little bit later, because it kind of ties in with another national case that occurred a few years before. Louisiana in 1927 had suffered a great flood, and there was no way, there was no FEMA back then. So if you got flooded out, you lost everything. And then we had the Great Depression, and of course we had the time of Huey Long. Everybody heard of Huey Long.
Right.
But in Shreveport, Louisiana, they had a high homeless. They had like little shanty towns and stuff like that. And there was a man, they called him the Butterfly Man, and he used to go around selling little trinkets, little hair pins for girls. And one day, one of these, the Butterfly Man, as they called him, around this neighborhood in Shreveport, went to the house of a young girl by the name of May Geffen, and she was 15 years old. And he asked May's mother, look, can I borrow your daughter for a little while so she can help me, take care of my wife? Because she's an invalid. And he kept begging and begging and begging. And finally, the mother says, okay. Well, what happens is 2 days later, May's body is found in the woods near what they called Albert Green Woods. No, I'm sorry, not Albert Green Woods. It's called Cross Lake. And to some people that saw the body later, law enforcement, they said, this crime scene looks familiar. I wonder where we've seen this crime scene from. And they kind of stored it in the back of their head. She had been sexually assaulted, but her legs had been parted and her belongings were neatly stacked. And so they did an autopsy. They found out that she had died from strangulation. She had a couple of stab wounds. And they kind of remember this butterfly man. They went looking for him, actually. And so later on, they run across three homeless guys, and they get them each to confess. So each one of them confesses to the crime, okay?
As an individual or as a group?
As an individual. They each confess to the crime. And now what we see is details from the crime that were published in the newspaper. They knew them verbatim, except one of them. And what happened was May Geffen's mother, a lady by the name of Mrs. Taylor, Mrs. Peters, identified one of them as the gentleman that they saw taking her daughter. Well, she misidentified it, is what happened.
Oh, great.
Okay.
Yeah, there was no lineup.
Oh, yeah, it gets better. So in April, mid-April 1934, a gentleman by the name of Fred Lockhart confesses to the crime, but he starts giving details that weren't published. And one thing I can never understand, Al, is when you have a confession, why do you put somebody on trial if you have a confession already? And in Louisiana, I figured it out. Because if he confesses, you have to make a deal. If he confesses and you put him on trial, you can still get the death penalty. So Fred Lockhart confesses to the crime. There's no doubt that he did it. And they put him on trial. And they convict him, and his sentence is death. But it's not done. He makes statements stating that he was involved in a crime in 1913 in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, if you know anything about what happened in 1913 in Atlanta, Georgia, that's the Mary Fagan case where Leo Frank was lynched. And so law enforcement starts trying to make connections, because what he's doing, Fred Lockhart's doing, is he's trying to stall for time.
And, just like serial killers do.
Oh yeah. Like, Henry Lee Lucas and,
yes,
and Otis Toole and all them. So what he does is he says, I may have been involved in the crime, but I was the driver of the car that took Leo Frank to the lynching site. When I read this, I said, okay, there are ways to check this out. Okay. Well, he was in Georgia at the time. He had been convicted and sentenced to a work farm in 1917 for sexual assault. And if you look at the autopsy report from Mary Fagan, it's almost identical to the autopsy of May Geffen. But Virginia authorities said they didn't have any record of it. Well, if they didn't have any record of it, how did I find it? That he had been in Georgia, that he escaped from the chain gang and been on the run ever since. So it ties in to one of the most famous crimes where an innocent man, now we know, was convicted and lynched because of, you know, it's just hysterics. Hysterics can convict anybody, Al. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
And so that was the connection between Fred Lockhart and the Fagan murder, you see. And a lot of people said, well, they saw a guy named Jim Conley bring Mary Fagan's body down to the basement. But anybody that's not associated with the crime doesn't know what the signature is like. And the signatures were almost exactly alike for makeup and Mary Faded.
Well, what about the neatly stacked clothes? Because to me, that would be part of the signature.
Well, it was, but the thing was with Mary Fagan, I was looking at the wounds, all right, mm-hmm. and the autopsy report, and I have a friend of mine who's a pathologist. It's amazing, Al, the kind of people you meet when you write about true crime. And she looked at the two autopsy reports. She says she didn't want to say 100%, but she said about 85 to 90% this was the same killer. And I didn't tell her who they were. And she says, yeah, these wounds are alike, and there was no mention. I think there was some mention about, because Mary Fagan had gone up there to get her pay, all right, and they didn't answer the question as to whether she had it or not. But that's what I was going on, and it made for an interesting story because people in the southern part of the state never heard of it. So when they started, I didn't know that happened in Shreveport. I said, yeah, it happened in Shreveport. So, and I would get gigged a lot of times because, oh, all you concentrate on is crimes that happened in New Orleans and around the South. Well, what else is there? What other place is there? You know, I mean, I'm a little conceited about it.
Yeah.
And that's what I believe. And as writers, you know, we make the best cases we can. And, you know, I saw the death certificates and I looked at the records, the prison records, and there was a Fred Lockhart in Georgia at that time who had been arrested after Leo Frank's lynching. And I said, okay, well, this is too much of a coincidence. And so in the book, I kind of laid out a case to where Fred Lockhart was the murderer of both of them.
Amazing. Now, your book is available everywhere, I imagine, like Amazon and all good bookstores.
Oh, yeah, good bookstores, yeah. It's down at Sal's Trunk or something. No, it's available on Barnes & Noble. It's available through the publisher, McFarland, the three books that I mentioned. And, you know, I didn't mean to plug them, but, you know, my daughter's in a private school, fellas, okay?
Yeah. That's
so
good.
So they're at Barnes & Noble, and if you just Google my name, you'll see the books come up. And we have, you know, like I said, I was looking forward to this show, Al. I really was, because I never done anything that kind of went outside of New Orleans, and I told all my friends, and they're so excited. So, you know, we're having. I love to have a good time when I talk about this stuff. And frankly, you know, when you talk to people about true crime, some of them get turned off by it. They're really, oh, that's disgusting. I'm like,
yeah.
But yet, other times, you know, when I was single, I should have realized that you could really impress the chicks with stuff like this. You know, I know that.
Better than being Mick Jagger.
I'm sorry,
ladies. No.
Yeah. So that's
Barnes & Noble.
Go ahead. Man.
No, never mind.
Oh, okay.
This delay is killing me.
Yeah. But, well, okay. So we'll have the book on as well as you on our website. So it's all good for people. Thanks for being on the show.
No problem. Hopefully I can come.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll tell you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.